I want to begin my sermon today with a reading from the FBI files. May 31st, 1951, FBI Special Agent Philip Reed wrote a memo. A man called at the Boston office and talked with me. He said he is a member of the Unitarian Church in Wayland, Massachusetts. He stated that about November 1950, Mr. Raymond Manker became minister of that church. Since he has assumed that position, he has impressed his parishioners as being a brilliant man, but with extreme ideas along social lines. The man was particularly suspicious of Mr. Manker because Manker seemed to be strongly opposed to the government's position so far as the war in Korea is concerned. Manker had made the statement that the American people should resist in every way anything the government should do related to the war. He urged non-participation in such activities. On May 27, 1951, at the morning service, he invited a young man to the pulpit to speak. This was the Sunday given over to the church high school group of which the young man was a member. The young man talked for about 20 to 25 minutes, and his talk was, in its substance, a tirade against capitalism. He quoted Theodore Parker, saying that money is the root of all evil. He criticized the government's policies concerning relief and said that the government's policy with regard to India was based on imperialism rather than humanitarianism. After the young man's talk, Mr. Manker made a number of conflicting statements concerning him. He said he had furnished the young man with material on which the latter had based his opinion, but claimed that he, Manker, did not know what the young man was actually going to talk about. Manker's wife said that Manker had told her that he agreed entirely with the sentiments expressed by the young man, but since then he has changed his mind, his views, overnight. The man further stated that Mr. Manker has antagonized many people in the church, as he has associated almost exclusively with the so-called ultra-liberals among the membership, to the great exclusion of others. The church has suffered greatly since Manker came there because of this split in the membership. He described the subject as follows: name, Raymond Manker, age 26 or 27, height, 5'10.5", weight, 145 pounds, build, slim, eyes, unknown color, hair, black, complexion, fair to ruddy, particularities, wears glasses, dark-rimmed, no mustache. He requested, the caller requested, that under no circumstances should his name be mentioned in connection with this matter. 30 years after an FBI agent wrote this memo, the government sent the memo to Reverend Ray Manker. He requested it under the Freedom of Information Act. This report is of personal interest to me because Ray Manker was my minister in Phoenix, Arizona when I was a child. Ray officiated at my mother's memorial service. Ray went with me to the draft board when I applied for status as a conscientious objector. Ray encouraged me to become a Unitarian Universalist minister. He delivered the sermon at my ordination. He's obviously been a very important person in my life. Before he came to Phoenix, Ray was a minister in Southern California. In his FBI file from the time, there was an anonymous letter to the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, J. Edgar Hoover, from someone who was angry with Ray. This letter passed through the offices of the number two man, Clyde Towson, and Alan Belmont, head of the Domestic Intelligence Division in Washington. The Domestic Intelligence Division in Washington requested more information on Ray Manker from the Bureau's office in Los Angeles and from the Boston office. The Boston office reported the following: And as you hear this, think about the investigation that was required to get this information. He was residing in Massachusetts during the early 1950s, and while there was on the mailing lists of New England Citizens Concerned for Peace and the Southern Conference Education Fund, Incorporated. As minister of a church in Wayland, Massachusetts, he was described as being quite liberal in that he defended Russian policy and some aspects of communism and was critical of United States policies, particularly with regard to Korea. In 1956, he urged his parishioners to attend a meeting sponsored by the Citizens Committee to Preserve American Freedoms to protest the subpoenaing of musicians to appear before the House Committee on Un-American Activities. Well, today Ray Manker is living in assisted living in Phoenix, Arizona. As far as I know, these reports on him are still in the government archives. All the activities that the memo describes were and are legal. Nevertheless, the information was collected and kept on file. It illustrates how it is possible in the United States to be subject to government spying, even when we have committed no crime. I first heard about how the National Security Agency was storing our phone records back in the middle of the last decade, back around 2006. I was visiting my cousin Rick Wiebe in San Francisco, a lawyer in San Francisco, and he told me that the Electronic Frontier Foundation had hired him to sue American Telephone and Telegraph on behalf of its customers for violating the privacy laws. I learned from my cousin that AT&T collaborated with the National Security Agency in a massive illegal program to wiretap and data mine Americans' communications. This was in 2006, I heard about this. The case that my cousin filed included undisputed evidence provided by a former AT&T technician showing that AT&T had routed copies of internet traffic to a secret room in San Francisco, controlled by the National Security Agency. Well, my cousin Rick won this case in court. But while it was on appeal, in response, in 2008, the United States Congress, both the House and the Senate, passed a law giving AT&T and other telecommunication companies retroactive immunity from liability for participation in warrantless surveillance programs, killing the court case. Congress passed this law because the National Security Agency insisted that the collection of phone records in bulk was stopping terror incidences. Although this evidence of government spying of our phone calls and our internet activity became public in 2006, most people were not concerned. This changed last June when Edward Snowden revealed the operational details of the global surveillance of the National Security Agency. Starting last summer, some members of Congress asked the administration if all this spying was truly helping to protect Americans. Now, the first answer to that was, well, there are 54 cases of terrorism that we have prevented because of this. But the members of Congress asked for more details of this. And as they got the details, in the end, the NSA could only document a single case where it had actually made any difference. Because of this gathering of our phone data, a court convicted a San Diego cab driver of sending $8,500 to a Somali terrorist group. It's the only case that they could document where it made a difference. The president appointed, handpicked a review group on intelligence and communications, and they issued their report in December of 2013. Now, these were not wild-eyed radicals. These were people who have careers in the intelligence community, conservative people who are mostly biased in favor of collecting data. And they announced in December of 2013 in their report that the phone records program added no unique value to the many surveillance programs already underway. No value. More information on global surveillance appears each week, more revelations. So on Thursday, the British newspaper The Guardian reported that the National Security Agency had helped a British intelligence agency called the Government Communications Headquarters, or GCHQ, to intercept and store the webcam images of millions of internet users. The surveillance program was codenamed Optical Nerve. It collected still images of Yahoo webcam chats in bulk and saved them to the British Government Communications Headquarters databases. Now, why did our National Security Agency help the British intelligence do this? Well, I would speculate that one reason is in this way the NSA can spy on us without violating United States law. There are no restrictions under British law to prevent the British spy agency from intercepting and storing images of citizens of the United States. The Guardian reported that the webcam spying produced some unexpected results. You have to have a sense of humor here. A leaked document put it this way. Unfortunately, it would appear that a surprising number of people use webcam conversations to show intimate parts of their body to the other person. The document estimates that up to 11% of Yahoo intercepted webcam images contains undesirable nudity. Well, should I, Roger Fritz, should I be afraid? I mean, when I use the webcam, I keep my clothes on. What do I have to worry about? I have nothing to hide. Why should I be afraid? Information is power. In the words of the American Civil Liberties Union, even if you lead a quiet life, you run the risk that someday you might end up in a power struggle, however big or small, with someone who controls or can access sensitive information about your life. Information is power. Governments gather information about us, and they also try to control the distribution of information. So let me tell you another story. 25 years ago, a Unitarian Universalist named Tim Berners-Lee invented the World Wide Web. Actually, the date of his memo was March 12, 1989. 25 years ago this month. Tim says, always date your memos. He wrote, the hope would be to allow a pool of information to develop, which could grow and evolve with the organization and the projects it describes. For this to be possible, the method of storage must not place its own restrictions on the information. This is why a web of notes with links like references between them is far more useful than a fixed hierarchical system, the beginning of what we almost all use today. Today, as the director of the World Wide Web Consortium, which oversees the web's continued development, Tim Berners-Lee functions as a kind of benevolent dictator. He believes in open sharing of information, and that belief has made the World Wide Web what it is today. Information is power. Tim wants to empower everyone by making it easy for all of us to access information. In 2012, he was honored at the opening ceremony of the Summer Olympics in London. And he did a tweet, which then appeared in the darkness across the people who were there, a tweet that said, "This is for everyone." The World Wide Web Consortium is at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Berners-Lee often receives emails from people suggesting ways to improve the web. Many emails. He refers these, the good ones, to working groups. In the late 90s, he started receiving excellent ideas by email from someone he had never heard of, someone named Aaron Schwartz. He was so impressed with Aaron Schwartz's ideas that he asked Schwartz to serve on one of the core working groups to review the new ideas that were coming in. With members from all over the world, this elite group of computer programmers would confer by email and decide by email about the rules that would govern the web. In 2000, Berners-Lee decided that it would be useful for everyone to come to MIT and meet face-to-face so that people could actually see each other, the folks who were on this important working group. So he got the funds together and emailed an invitation to everyone in the working group and received an email back from Aaron Schwartz saying that in order for him to travel to Cambridge, Massachusetts, he would first have to get permission from his mother. Berners-Lee emailed back, "Aaron, how old are you?" 14, Aaron replied. Well, Aaron went on to attend Stanford University, and he became passionate about preserving the open, free flow of information on the web, a true disciple of Tim Berners-Lee, that this is an open sharing of information. In 2006, at the age of 20, Aaron created the Open Library, an online project intended to create one web page for every book that had ever been published. He downloaded the Library of Congress's complete bibliographic database and published it on Open Library. Well, the Library of Congress was charging fees to access this data, and Schwartz posted it on the Open Library and made it available free of charge. And in this way, the Library of Congress lost control of its information and lost its income from those fees. An investigation followed into this 20-year-old's activities. Well, it turns out that the data of the Library of Congress, because it's a government agency, is not copy protected. And because of this, the government did not prosecute Aaron Schwartz. Schwartz continued this crusade for open access, free access to information. In 2008, the now 22-year-old downloaded and released 2.7 million federal court documents. Now, these are federal court documents are public documents. But the federal courts who had possession of them were charging 8 cents a page to download. They were using this fee, they said, to finance technology, to help pay for the technology to have this available. But that fund that they had charged 8 cents a page for had a surplus of $150 million in it. Schwartz made the court documents freely available to anyone without charge. There was another investigation. And investigators ultimately decided not to press charges because the documents were, in fact, public. In 2010, 24-year-old Schwartz took on JSTOR. JSTOR is short for Journal Storage. It is a digital library containing back issues of academic journals. For a fee, it provides full-text searches of almost 2,000 academic journals. Schwartz saw JSTOR as an example of an elite controlling intellectual property, limiting access to information, available only to those who had access to a university library or those who could pay for the articles. So in late 2010 and early 2011, using MIT computers, Schwartz downloaded many academic journal articles from JSTOR. However, before he could post these academic articles on the web, MIT police arrested Aaron Schwartz, and a federal grand jury indicted him on charges of wire fraud, computer fraud, unlawfully obtaining information from a protected computer, and recklessly damaging a protected computer. For months, Schwartz's lawyers negotiated with federal prosecutors. Nearly 2 years after the arrest, on January 9, 2013, prosecutors offered a plea deal. They said Schwartz would have to spend 6 months in prison and plead guilty to 13 charges if he wanted to avoid going to trial. They said if Schwartz did not plead guilty, the prosecutor would seek a sentence of 7 years in prison if he was convicted. 2 days later, January 11th, 2013, Aaron Schwartz hung himself. No suicide note was found. He was 26 years old. Trying to understand his death, his girlfriend said that Schwartz lacked the money to pay for a trial and that it was too hard for him to make that part of his life go public by asking for help. He was also distressed, she said, because prosecutors had just subpoenaed two of his friends to testify against him. At Schwartz's funeral, his friend Tim Berners-Lee delivered the eulogy. After his death, the American Library Association awarded Aaron Schwartz their James Madison Award for being an outspoken advocate for public participation in government and unrestricted access to peer-reviewed scholarly articles. Information is power. Governments gather information, and they also try to control the distribution of information. So today I admire my minister, Ray Manker, who remains steadfast in his values, even while Hoover's FBI investigated him. Today I admire Tim Berners-Lee, who invented a system for open sharing of information and who continues to work to preserve this openness. Today I admire Aaron Schwartz, who in his short life worked to make the web like a free library that everyone can access. And I admire Edward Snowden for revealing the extent of the global surveillance of the National Security Agency. Should we be afraid of invasions of our privacy? Should we be afraid of attempts to limit access to information? Well, short bursts of fear can help us survive. Fear can help us jump out of the way of a poisonous snake. Fear can help us jump quickly to avoid a poisonous spider. However, chronic fear is not helpful. Chronic anxiety can make it difficult for us to think clearly or act effectively. It does not help to lay awake at night worrying about these things. Chronic fear can make us physically sick. It can even kill us. So the answer to my question posed in the sermon title is no. To survive in the 21st century, chronic fear, worry, and anxiety are not helpful. As sailors know, when we are out on a boat in a rough sea, to survive, we need to remain calm and clear-headed. In the same way, we need to be calm and non-anxious in all our interactions in life. Therefore, in my own case, to remain calm, I try to exercise. I go on bike rides. I take walks on the beach. I listen to restful music. I engage in prayer and meditation. And I go to church each week. The choir calms me. And then, having entered this state of calm bliss, I can take action. I support the American Civil Liberties Union. I support the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And I give thanks and offer my support to all who work to protect our privacy while preserving free access to information.